and to extract a piece of the Earth's mantle for examination at leisure. The thinking was that if they could understand the nature of the rocks inside the Earth, they might begin to understand how they interacted, and thus possibly be able to predict earthquakes and other unwelcome events. The project became known, all but inevitably, as the MOHOLE, and it was pretty well disastrous. The hope was to lower a drill through 14,000 feet of Pacific Ocean water off the coast of Mexico and drill some 17,000 feet through relatively thin crustal rock. Drilling from a ship in open water is, in the words of one oceanographer, like trying to drill a hole in the sidewalks of New York from atop the Empire State Building using a strand of spaghetti. Every attempt ended in failure. The deepest they penetrated was only about 600 feet. The MOHOLE became known as the NO-HOLE. In 1966, exasperated with ever-rising costs and no results, Congress killed the project. 4 years later, Soviet scientists decided to try their luck on dry land. They chose a spot on Russia's Kola Peninsula, near the Finnish border, and set to work with the hope of drilling to a depth of 15 kilometers. The work proved harder than expected, but the Soviets were commendably persistent. When at last they gave up, 19 years later, they had drilled to a depth of 12,262 meters, or about 7.6 miles. Bearing in mind that the crust of the Earth represents only about 0.3% of the planet's volume, and that the Kola hole had not cut even one-third of the way through the crust, we can hardly claim to have conquered the interior. Interestingly, even though the hole was modest, nearly everything about it was surprising. Seismic wave studies had led the scientists to predict, and pretty confidently, that they would encounter sedimentary rock to a depth of 4,700 meters, followed by granite for the next 2,300 meters, and basalt from there on down. In the event, the sedimentary layer was 50% deeper than expected, and the basaltic layer was never found at all. Moreover, the world down there was far warmer than anyone had expected, with a temperature at 10,000 meters of 180 degrees centigrade, nearly twice the forecasted level. Most surprising of all was that the rock at that depth was saturated with water, something that had not been thought possible. Because we can't see into the Earth, we have to use other techniques, which mostly involve reading waves as they travel through the interior. We also know a little bit about the mantle from what are known as kimberlite pipes, where diamonds are formed. What happens is that deep in the Earth, there is an explosion that fires, in effect, a cannonball of magma to the surface at supersonic speeds. It is a totally random event. A kimberlite pipe could explode in your backyard as you read this. Because they come up from such depths, up to 120 miles down, kimberlite pipes bring up all kinds of things not normally found on or near the surface. A rock called peridotite, crystals of olivine, and, just occasionally, in about one pipe in 100, diamonds. Lots of carbon comes up with kimberlite ejecta, but most is vaporized or turns to graphite. Only occasionally does a hunk of it shoot up at just the right speed and cool down with the necessary swiftness to become a diamond. It was such a pipe that made Johannesburg the most productive diamond mining city in the world, but there may be others even bigger that we don't know about. Geologists know that somewhere in the vicinity of northeastern Indiana, there is evidence of a pipe or group of pipes that may be truly colossal. Diamonds up to 20 carats or more have been found at scattered sites throughout the region, but no one has ever found the source. As John McPhee notes, it may be buried under glacially deposited soil like the Manson Crater in Iowa, or under the Great Lakes. So how much do we know about what's inside the Earth? Very little. Scientists are generally agreed that the world beneath us is composed of four layers: rocky outer crust, a mantle of hot, viscous rock, a liquid outer core, and a solid inner core. We know that the surface is dominated by silicates, which are relatively light and not heavy enough to account for the planet's overall density. Therefore, there must be heavier stuff inside. We know that to generate our magnetic field somewhere in the interior, there must be a concentrated belt of metallic elements in a liquid state. That much is universally agreed upon. Almost everything beyond that, how the layers interact, what causes them to behave in the way they do, what they will do at any time in the future, is a matter of at least some uncertainty, and generally quite a lot of uncertainty. Even the one part of it we can see, the crust, is a matter of some fairly strident debate. Nearly all geology texts tell you that continental crust is 3 to 6 miles thick under the oceans, about 25 miles thick under the continents, and 40 to 60 miles thick under big mountain chains. But there are many puzzling variabilities within these generalizations. The crust beneath the Sierra Nevada mountains, for instance, is only about 19 to 25 miles thick, and no one knows why. By all the laws of geophysics, the Sierra Nevadas should be sinking as if into quicksand. Some people think they may be. How and when the Earth got its crust are questions that divide geologists into two broad camps: those who think it happened abruptly, early in the Earth's history, and those who think it happened gradually and rather later. Strength of feeling runs deep on such matters. Richard Armstrong of Yale proposed an early burst theory in the 1960s, then spent the rest of his career fighting those who did not agree with him. He died of cancer in 1991, but shortly before his death, he lashed out at his critics in a polemic in an Australian earth science journal that charged them with perpetuating myths, according to a report in Earth magazine in 1998. He died a bitter man, reported a colleague. The crust and part of the outer mantle together are called the lithosphere, from the Greek lithos, meaning stone, which in turn floats on top of a layer of softer rock called the asthenosphere, from Greek words meaning without strength. But such terms are never entirely satisfactory. To say that the lithosphere floats on top of the asthenosphere suggests a degree of easy buoyancy that isn't quite right. Similarly, it is misleading to think of the rocks as flowing in anything like the way we think of materials flowing on the surface. The rocks are viscous, but only in the same way that glass is. It may not look it, but all the glass on Earth is flowing downward, under the relentless drag of gravity. Remove a pane of really old glass from the window of a European cathedral, and it will be noticeably thicker at the bottom than at the top. That is the sort of flow we are talking about. The hour hand on a clock moves about 10,000 times.